Well, here we are. It's December 19th, 2018. The Farm Bill has passed both houses of Congress and now awaits the president's signature. What effect will this have on the existing hemp pilot programs here in Pennsylvania? This is the Lancaster Farming Industrial Hemp Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Herlock. And on the first part of our show today, we'll hear from Russell Redding, the Secretary of Agriculture here in Pennsylvania, and we'll find out what this new Farm Bill has in store for farmers. And then we'll talk to an eighth-generation fruit grower from Adams County, Pennsylvania, who grew hemp this year for the very first time. But first, here's Russell Redding.
Hello, Derek. Hi, Russell Redding here.
Okay, so the president, who is generally unpredictable, is expected to sign the Farm Bill into law this week. Where does that leave Pennsylvania's hemp pilot program for 2019?
Yeah, so when the president signs the Farm Bill, it will give us a green light to obviously push forward with industrial hemp development in Pennsylvania. Important will be the removal of the Schedule I status of industrial hemp. It will allow us to revisit this issue of the number of permits we issue and the caps that we place on the program, just from a management standpoint, that are part of what we obligated to under the previous Farm Bill. So that is all sort of part of the change that we anticipate here with the signing of the Farm Bill.
So that means what exactly for farmers who want to grow hemp? They still need to apply?
Yeah, so this is sort of the interesting piece of this. So if you look at the Farm Bill and the industrial hemp language, there are a couple of things. One is it still requires the state to have a plan, which is approved by the USDA. And we believe with our 2014 Farm Bill status and what we've done the last 2 years, we've got the makings of that plan. It still requires each of the growers to register with the Department of Agriculture. So regardless of what the acreage is, if you're producing it, you still have to register with the department and give us the coordinates of those fields where that plant is located. Those things are, part of our existing plan, so that's just a carry forward. The important thing, though, it gets rid of this issue of cap of the numbers of those people, right? We had said for 2019, a cap for both acreage and individual permits, that goes away just as soon as we have the green light from the president.
Do you expect the procurement of seed to be easier for farmers? Can they buy seed domestically now?
Yes. So that's the other improvement is we had already approved the interstate shipment and sourcing of seed as part of our 2019 plan. But with the Farm Bill passage, we expect a lot of domestic seed purchased. And you'll have some importation of seed just based on relationships that have been established. But the expectation would be that would be easier to source as well.
I see on the Department of Agriculture's website that you've stopped accepting applications for the 2019 program.
For the moment. So I have 82 as of yesterday that have come in under the 2019 guidelines that we've established. That was the close. Monday was the close of our 2019 application period. We are anticipating with the signage by signing of the Farm Bill by the president is that we'll go back and then reopen it. But we're holding on that for the moment just because there are some pieces of that are unknown. One example is to what extent that the USDA will accept our plan that we established without the Farm Bill, pre-Farm Bill, as a plan for the, as required by the Farm Bill for going forward. So we didn't want to prejudge that with the USDA. We're waiting for guidance from them to know for sure. But the goal is here to live true to what the Farm Bill is allowing us, which is more of an open market, an open opportunity. At the same time, not misleading any of our growers who have an interest. We just need some clear guidance from USDA.
Now, does the Pennsylvania state government, are you guys ramping up any financial efforts to help build the infrastructure and supply chain so we can compete with, states like Kentucky or New York who are putting a lot of money into the program?
Yeah, so you know, the two states you mentioned, there are states that have done, you know, a separate appropriation and or at least a carve out within the economic development programs for industrial hemp. We haven't done the carve out. There have been, you know, several conversations with our Department of Community and Economic Development about financial support for it. I think this crop, and again with the Farm Bill, it legitimizes this crop as a crop. Right, it doesn't have a special status any longer. It's eligible for, you know, any financial assistance that we would provide to other crops in PA. So, and we have been approached by some folks interested in different parts of that. The conversations have been positive. The conversations have been well treated as any other economic development project for assistance.
And hemp growers will be eligible for crop insurance?
Yeah, that's the other change with the Farm Bill. So again, legitimizing this crop, it does two things for farms that farmers directly. One is the makes them eligible for crop insurance, but also allows them to compete for USDA grants. You know, there are really, you know, two of the limitations we've experienced the last couple of years. So that'll be nice. It at least makes it equal to other crops and says we're not going to discriminate against, you know, this crop or growers who produce it. It's going to be equal to to other crops that we produce and treated as such.
Okay. Any advice for farmers who missed the deadline but still want to grow hemp next year?
Yeah, I would say the farmers, you know, we're in this sort of funny status of our program guidelines have closed for 2019 that we published. We're waiting on signature. You're going to see, you know, some additional guidance coming within the next week or so. And just stay tuned to, you know, the department's website or our, you know, communication staff. We'll put that out as soon as we have guidance and know what the USDA is going to require of us in terms of a plan. And then making sure that we can, you know, get an early word out for folks who want to put this in their 2019 crop or rotation plans to make sure that we do that here as early as possible in the 2019 year.
Secretary Redding, thank you for your time this morning.
Yeah, glad to do it. And as soon as we have guidance on those changes, we'll come back to you. Okay, so you know firsthand what we're doing, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks again, and Merry Christmas.
Yeah, same to you. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to jump into a conversation with 8th-generation fruit farmer, 1st-generation hemp farmer, Leighton Rice from Adams County, Pennsylvania. Stick around. Hey, listeners. If you're not a current subscriber to Lancaster Farming Newspaper, now's your chance. We have a special deal for you. Just go to lancasterfarming.com/podcastdeal for a discounted offer on the number one agricultural newspaper in the Mid-Atlantic region. You can subscribe now for $39 for the whole year, saving you $65 over the newsstand price. Or pick up a two-year subscription at $75, saving you an incredible $133 over the newsstand price. You cannot beat this value. Plus, as a subscriber, you get 2 free mailbox market ads per month to sell anything you want. What's a mailbox market ad? It's an exclusive classified ad that only appears in Lancaster Farming. So your subscription will pay for itself. Remember, this deal is only for new subscribers and rates may increase after the first term is up. So check it out, lancasterfarming.com/podcastdeal. Okay, back to the show. Hi, Leighton. Welcome to the Lancaster Farming Podcast. Could you introduce yourself for us?
Absolutely. My name is Leighton Rice. Thank you for having me on your show. I have been working in the fruit industry for about 12 years now, and I am an 8th-generation fruit grower here in Adams County.
Okay, so you're out in Adams County, 8th-generation fruit grower. But this year you started growing industrial hemp. What made you decide to get into that?
A friend of a friend who I was visiting in, he lives in Las Vegas. That was it was a little over a year ago. He was already in the hemp industry, so his background actually was cannabis, which was fully decriminalized in Nevada a few years ago, I believe.
Okay.
So his business evolved, I guess beforehand, he had been working more on the service end in that industry. So they came up with some kind of certification for people who wanted to get into the cannabis industry, teaching them how to trim flower and I guess just other basic skills of handling and sales.
Okay.
That business is called Trim Ready. So basically then he was looking to expand operations, was looking for a partner on the East Coast that was, say, in agriculture, had connections, had access to land, some background, some interest. And I guess I, you know, fit the bill there. And we put together a proposal and we were accepted as one of the permittees in Pennsylvania last year. And great. I think we're going to continue this year.
So how many acres were you growing?
So we grew, it was 6 acres total. It was hard to get a real accurate number on that because we had some losses from the start, kind of areas that we had to plant around. There was a waterway that cut through our plot, mm-hmm. which when we did get around to planting, what I would consider late July and early August, some of it, of course you're heading into what you expect is the dry season.
Right.
And I thought, well, maybe planting close to the waterway is not a bad idea at that point. And then that was about the time that it started raining and never stopped. So, I think we did have probably at least 25% losses just from root rot, or we even had washout.
Oh, wow.
Which that was incredible. But other than that, I would say that, you know, because what we have here is kind of light, gravelly soils on the foothills of the Appalachians, which are ideal for tree crops because, again, you always want a little bit of adversity because you don't want to be growing plant material. You want to be growing fruit, and essentially the fruiting response is a stress response. So on a per acre basis, you're trying to maximize, you know, say pounds of fruit, but in this case it's pounds of fruit of hemp buds.
Right.
And I do think that say your fruiting potential for hemp is going to be on a similar sort of arc to what it would be on a tree crop.
Okay.
In the sense that you're not going to have plant material outpacing your fruiting material and still end up with something that you could manage from a harvest standpoint.
In order to get the permit, you needed to submit some kind of a research plan. What was your research plan there?
I believe it was something like horticultural method and retail experiment or something.
Okay.
Each one kind of has a title, but they're generic. But what we set out to do and what we did was, because growing for smokable CBD flower, I don't know if there was even one other permittee that did that in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Most of them was either for seed and fiber strains planted and grown as a field crop, or they maybe were growing CBD, but for extraction. So,
so what did you use to plant? What equipment?
There was nothing really sophisticated about what we did. So we laid out the rows, same way I would lay out a field for apples, flagging the rows. And so then I sprayed the strips. We were at a 9x9 spacing.
Okay.
which was my best guess, and based on a little bit of research, I think if we do it next year, we'll probably plant and make our drive metals larger, but we'll probably triple plant our rows for various reasons. But even that 9x9 spacing by the end, it was too tight for the drive row. But in between plants, we had a lot of gaps because we started with non-feminized seed for most of it, and then double planted at our desired spacing,
okay,
assuming we would cull out males, which it did work out that way, but essentially it doesn't, from a horticultural standpoint, work out in such an ideal way because you can't select ahead of time which are going to be males, and you end up with big holes, and then that's just that's where the weeds are going to set up. And we struggled in the beginning with having enough management to really put things into practice like pre-emergence that would have saved us a lot of time down the road. I think we probably made 3 or 4 passes through the entire field with a weed whacker. But I did spray Roundup ahead of time, so we had a nice strip ready to go. Before that, actually, I had rotovated their strips twice, and then even after I sprayed them down, I thought it made sense to break up the ground again a little bit before we planted, but I didn't want to rotovate after we already had good weed suppression.
Right.
So I ran through with a subsoiler,
right,
at about 1 to 1.5 feet. So I just had a very narrow cut. And so that made it easy when we came through right after that, just to throw the plants in the ground, which we had been germinating and growing indoors since mid-May. Some of them we germinated and grew outdoors, so in plug trays, which we even at one point had to transplant into larger pots because they were not ready to go out. And we also had a wet spring, so I don't know that they would have done so well out there.
So you didn't plant direct into the field?
No, we didn't.
And then what was harvesting like? Did you do all that by hand?
Everything by hand, and it was a little bit, again, a very big learning curve there. The whole drying process is one that I've no experience there, no idea what to expect. We made a big mistake early on, thinking that we could save space by dry stripping. So harvest the plant and then strip it the way you normally would by running your fingers down all the laterals.
Okay.
And so you're pulling off the leaves and the buds and making a big pile.
Sure.
But you can't really do it that way, we found out, because we harvested, I don't know, say 10% of the crop on one weekend towards the end of September and tried to store them in bins. So in a controlled environment where we were controlling for humidity and temperature, but humidity is the main thing, trying to get down to that 40% that you need to complete the drying process.
Okay.
But of course it was, you know, anywhere from 70 to 100 on any given day in September. And just the way we had assembled it in bulk bins, apple bins, filled maybe half to two thirds full, just wasn't enough airflow, even if we had gotten down to our humidity. And I think it was molded through and a matter of hours, it seemed like.
Oh, wow.
So that seemed like a total loss. There's maybe some possibilities of extraction for that. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we had to go back to basically just hanging plants and had to build out a big section of a barn, had to set up another barn to be able to basically hang whole plants, or say like tying branches together, or and something that would resemble maybe like a tobacco operation, and then completing a full drying process in anywhere from 4 to 6 days to 8 days, depending on weather and stuff. And then it would be dry enough to strip. And then what we would have a semi-dried product that is called biomass in the industry. And then you sell that off either wholesale or you process it into a final product for the market.
So how were you with manpower? Did you have enough people helping you, or was this an all-consuming project for you?
It was definitely a lot more than I bargained for. I think management was the real difficulty, just because, you know, there's not that expertise out there. And you can't necessarily go and hire somebody out who, I mean, it's hard enough for us to find good managers in our industry, which is very established and, you know, over 100 years old, just in its current form, our business. So, yeah, going out to find someone who's going to run what seems like a pot farm, you know, and based on a lot of just real prospecting about an industry that's just starting. And we're still, you know, we're still feeling the effects of that, because we're sitting on a lot of product, which is not final product, but not far off. And we still really have no idea what it's worth.
And you're going to take sort of the same approach for next year, or how will you apply what you learned this year to next year?
Well, as far as managing the farm, growing the crop, we have a lot of new ideas about that, that I think will make a big difference. But all these unknowns about the market and about the industry are still very real. In fact, maybe even more so now after the passage of the Farm Bill. I don't know if it's actually passed, but...
No, it hasn't been signed yet, but it's been approved by both houses. So we're just waiting on a signature.
So, again, I don't think that, because there's a lot of states, really most states have some sort of a program. And I feel like everyone who's really has an interest is already participating through their state programs, because it's not, the barrier to entry is not very high. It's not very expensive. It's not a lot of paperwork. And in these other states where I don't even know what they're going to do, but supposedly the USDA or something is going to go in and set up some skeleton program for them to be able to still be registered somehow, and to grow. But in other words, I don't think that, you know, that the market is going to be flooded very quickly. But at the same time, I don't know if, say, CBD is just, you know, a buzzword for this year, and next year it's going to be something else. So right now it's something that you can make a lot of money if you have the right product and, you know, the right amount of it. But again, it's, who knows if that's, if it's just a fad or what.
So did you apply for the permit for next year?
We did apply to renew our permit under the same parameters. And when I went to drop it off on Friday, I believe it was due actually yesterday, but they said, oh yeah, we just found out this morning we were going to write an email that, you know, everything's off the table now because of the Farm Bill. And so we're going to have to change everything around. We don't know what the new costs are going to be, what the deadlines are, what to tell you about the seeds. So in a way, it's kind of freed things up at the federal level, at least in terms of marketing and transportation. But at the same time, for a lot of these state agencies that have already been doing it for a number of years, it kind of turned everything on its head. So,
did you have trouble procuring seeds in the beginning?
Yes.
Any good stories there?
Well, I mean, you understand that I don't know if every state was this way, but that the seeds had to be imported.
Right.
I guess the presumption there is that there are no states where the seeds could be produced legally or transported to the state legally.
Right.
My business partner had connections in Jamaica, of all places, with a business down there he was affiliated with, which he was able to procure the seeds that he wanted. But again, in his industry, strains and that kind of thing is a big deal because it's a big part of the marketing.
Right.
And that is something that changes quickly, you know, and that's something that I'm familiar with in the apple industry, but in the cannabis industry, it's, you know, it changes even faster because it's an annual crop.
Right.
So, and there's it's not really regulated from the standpoint of, you know, you grow something and you just call it whatever you want. And then, you know, that's the new hit strain or something.
Right. It's not like you can get certified seed at this point.
No. And as far as I know, there's not, you know, strains that are patented or brands that are trademarked or things like that.
So, you know, you said you're an eighth generation fruit grower. What did the seventh generation think about this hemp project?
They weren't, you know, ready just to dive in. I don't think any one of them had any particular interest or fascination with the hemp industry. And truthfully, I would say that I didn't either beforehand. And still my fascination is probably more horticulturally, because I mean, you see what it does. I see how it stood up to the weather. You see at the end, you have this stand I mentioned that's 7 feet, and you cut it at the trunk and it looks like a baseball bat.
Wow.
So I think that at least on the seed and fiber side, the things that people are saying that, you know, it could be a very viable future source of chemical or textiles. I think, you know, as an alternative to petroleum and that kind of stuff, I think that that's very valid. And, you know, I think that Americans are some of the best farmers in the world, and that once they really devote the time and the resources to learning how to do it well, that it could be a real forceful industry.
Sure.
But as far as I do think that the CBD thing is more of a fad than not. I there's a future for it. I don't know what it looks like, but it's really not where my interest is, but I do think there's a lot of money that can be made in this, you know, just as things are getting started here.
Okay, so speaking of all the interest in money that's sort of flowing around the CBD stuff, how can farmers avoid getting the short end of the stick in some of this? How can, you know, the guys growing this avoid getting taken advantage of by other parts of the industry?
Well, that's a tough one because, for one thing, your options are very limited, at least until the Farm Bill opens things up. But even then, there's some gray area because, from what I understand, the Farm Bill doesn't necessarily change the way that DEA, for example, has classified hemp, but it does maybe influence the way that people can appropriate money to prosecute alleged crimes related to hemp or marijuana. So there's no easy answer to that. I think just like in many other industries, the more versant that you can be and the more connections you have with customers to be able to retail things directly, whether it's online or even to have some kind of a storefront, or things like that. So in our case, it looks at this point like we're going to sell a lot of our product in envelopes. So something I'm trying to think that you would buy, like herbs or something at a fancy grocery store, with a nice label on it. And we might pack 30 or 40 grams in there, so an ounce or an ounce and a half. And we can retail that for a lot of money, but there's, you know, aside from growing it, there's not really much processing. There is going to be sales, but I think nowadays that should not be a big obstacle for people, the sales and marketing part of it. I think that the Farm Bill will make it easier for people to set up online businesses to handle credit card charges and stuff like that, because that was a big problem for my business partner, even in Nevada,
right.
You know, which has a hemp program and has had a legal cannabis program for at least a few years. So,
wow.
But the banks are not jumping on board yet either.
Right. They don't want to touch it at this point.
Too much unknown.
Right. So I'm curious what retail price you'll get for, you know, an ounce of CBD hemp.
I think what we're shooting for now is $1 a gram. So we would sell a 40 gram pack for $40. Some of that would go to wholesalers, which seems like a lot of money to me, but that's discounted from what he's doing in Nevada. He's probably more like $2 to $3 a gram.
And are you able to ship your product out to Nevada?
I don't believe so. Again, there's some gray area there. If it was seized, for example, first of all, there would be the challenge of convincing whoever takes possession of it that it's not marijuana.
Right.
You know, and that might involve testing. And then the way that, say, like a state police would test product would be different than a lab maybe that Pennsylvania Department of Ag would use, or that other people would use to test their product for retail. So I guess to drill down a little bit on that, people talk about Delta 9 THC, which is a component part of your total THC. There's different kinds of THC, but it's believed that Delta 9 is the one that has the most psychoactive properties.
Okay.
So I think that what they're regulating is total THC, but that might not be the case. Some states might regulate Delta 9, but then you have to be able to test for Delta 9. And my understanding is that, say, like a lot of these, you know, like if a police agency seizes and tests it, a lot of those tests is just positive or negative for THC. So it could actually be testing below the legal limit, but they're just looking for a positive. So what's happening in some states, maybe more conservative states like in the South, they'll go in and say seize a display of CBD products at a smoke shop or a gas station or something on the suspicion that maybe the shop owner or something is actually selling marijuana products fraudulently or something. And then they'll test it and it'll test positive for THC. And then they'll, you know, take them in and charge them. So that's happening in a lot of places.
So you've got about 6 acres of fiber left over. What are you going to do with that? Or what have you done with that?
So like the stock and all that stuff, we do still have that. It's just all in a big pile. My idea at the moment is to make that into like a decorative mulch.
Oh, okay.
I think it would make a nice mulch and that it would last a long time. And, you know, I think people would be interested in that and like the fact that it was hemp. And, you know, it's something that everyone's taken an interest.
Right.
So you throw that on there and then they'll buy it.
So what, you would just chip it up? shred it.
Yeah,
somehow.
Chip it. Maybe if there's any kind of a curing or a dye, you know, I've never done it, but
that's interesting.
But, you know, just like everything with this project, we just kind of go at it and try and figure it out one step at a time. We've made a lot of mistakes, but that was, you know, that's the point of all these research pilot programs, is for people to get back on the learning curve.
Right.
And, you know, compared to Europe, right, and places where it seems like they've been doing this now for a while.
Right. But for us, it's been out of the loop for 80 years or so. So no one really knows what they're doing anymore.
Right. And supposedly before that, it was a very important crop in the rotation in Pennsylvania,
right,
and many states. So.
Yep. So what advice would you give to farmers who are interested in growing hemp, either next year or at least some point in the future?
Well, you have to decide what your goals are, and you have to have some idea of your outlet, I think, at the start, because a lot of the permit holders just kind of went out and put in a field, whether they were growing it for seed and fiber, you know, very high density, or doing what we did. And then you just kind of figure, well, at the end of it, we'll have something and it'll be worth money. But I think a lot of them, maybe even now, are struggling to find the right outlet for it.
Right.
And just because there's a huge demand for hemp-derived products or CBD, doesn't mean that, you know, you're going to be able to connect up with them and or have what they're looking for. So, or maybe even more importantly, you don't know if you can provide that to them out of state.
What do you mean?
Processing and selling and shipping out of state. I think that's still a legal gray area. So,
right. Are you connected to the other growers? Like, is there some kind of networking group that you're involved in?
So there's there's the PA Hemp Industry Council. We're members of that.
Okay.
I think they have a Facebook page.
Yep. I've actually interviewed some of those folks.
Okay. It's just so easy to connect with people nowadays that, you know, you kind of hear about someone that's doing something or someone that's sourcing seeds from somewhere. And so there was one other grower in, not sure what county that is, near Allentown. And so he was doing something kind of similar to what we were doing on a smaller scale. I think he's going up to 10 acres next year.
Okay.
But he was doing raised beds with plastic. And so we were working closely with him, and, you know, we both faced some of the same heartaches with the water, caterpillars, mold, those kinds of things. So,
yeah, we'll see how next year goes, right? I can't imagine it'll be this rainy again next year, but we'll see.
But who knows, right? I mean, if climate change is real, and maybe it'll rain more next year, who knows?
I mean, I hear some people talking about how hemp could actually help, you know, mitigate climate change. You know, grow enough of it, it pulls carbon out of the atmosphere, that sort of thing. So maybe there's some hope there.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to believe, like, on a per acre basis, that you're converting more carbon dioxide than other field crops. But I don't know.
Any final words on growing industrial hemp?
Give it a try, and I don't think you have much to lose. Don't bet the farm on it. But I think everyone who is interested in it has something to gain by just getting on the learning curve. And I thank the people at the PA Department of Ag for getting on board with that 2 years ago, and for just helping growers and farmers look for alternative ways to make their businesses healthy and profitable.
Okay, Leighton Rice, thank you so much for joining us today on our show.
Excellent, thank you.
And thank you all for listening to today's show. I am your host, Eric Herlock, and I look forward to bringing you more stories about industrial hemp in the weeks to come. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send me an email, podcast@lancasterfarming.com. And also, check out lancasterfarming.com. There's a lot of great information for you there about farming. Okay, until next time, I'll see you in the newspaper.